compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Good morning and welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. We had our little 21-hour break and we are back at it. Cyrus and I are tanned and rested and ready. Aren't we, Cyrus? We're ready to go today, aren't we?
A man and a woman.
Yes, as per usual. The number is 888-914-9149. I like how Cyrus is learning how to deflect my questions. When I ask him a question, instead of answering, he'll play a
Come
sound
on, bit. Man.
I know. 888-914-9149. 888-914-9149. Lines are open right now. There's a new poll out. This is from Pew Research, and I will ask you about this in a moment, Cyrus, so be prepared. Without the sound effects, please. 7% of Americans, Pew Research says, don't use the internet. And I am actually very surprised that the number is that high, honestly. I would think that almost everybody, even if they don't necessarily realize it, maybe somebody who's elderly perhaps and doesn't get on a website or use a phone, nonetheless might have a smart appliance in the kitchen, which is phoning home through the internet. We call that the Internet of Things. Appliances and other devices that are connected to the internet, your Ring doorbell, for example. Now, I tend to think that's probably not what the Pew Research people had in mind when they asked this question, but here's how it broke down. For many Americans, going online is an important way to connect with friends and family, to shop, to get news, search for information, and let's face it, and also work. A lot of people now are working from home, something you could never do before if you didn't have internet access. Today, however, in this Pew poll that was conducted from January 25th to February 8th of this year, 7% of adults said they don't use it at all. Internet non-adoption is what they call that, is linked to a number of demographic variables, but is strongly connected to age. So older Americans, as you might imagine, continue to be among the least likely groups to use the internet. That's not surprising. Today, 25% of adults ages 65 and older report never going online, compared with much smaller shares of adults under the age of 60. Educational attainment, household income are also indicators of a person's likelihood to be offline. Some 14% of adults with a high school education or less do not use the internet, but that share falls as the level of educational attainment increases. Adults living in households earning less than $30,000 a year are far more likely than those whose annual household income is $75,000 or more to report not using the internet. Now, I found that actually hard to imagine. I would have guessed it would have been the opposite. Here's why. Because for many people who are, let's say, at the low end of the economic spectrum, they may not even be able necessarily to afford like a cable bill for TV. They all, seems to me, have phones like the rest of us do. And with their phones, they're accessing the internet. So I thought that was counterintuitive, that if you make under $30,000 a year, you're far more likely to not be on the internet, to not be using the internet, than if you make $75,000 a year or more. There are no statistically significant differences in non-internet use by gender, race, ethnicity, or community type. Interesting. Despite some groups having persistently lower rates of internet adoption, the vast majority of Americans are now online. As ongoing government and social service programs encourage internet adoption in underserved areas. Over time, Pew Research says, the nation's offline population has been shrinking, and for some groups that change has been especially dramatic. For example, 86% of adults ages 65 and older who did not go online in 2000, of that number, it has now fallen to just about 25%. So let me just repeat that. In 2000, so 20 plus years ago, 86% of adults ages 65 and older never went online. You've got mail. They never heard that. They never had America Online, at least back in those days. And now it's maybe 25%. The share of offline adults ages 50 to 64 has dropped 8 percentage points since 2019. The share of various ethnic groups, Black and Hispanic, etc. So in the Black and Hispanic cohort, adults have fallen significantly during that period from 15% to 9%, et cetera. So it's fascinating, and you may be able to figure out where you fall in all this. Cyrus, I was going to ask you about this. Aside from work, okay, so not counting what you have to do for this program, which is a fair amount of stuff online, how would you classify yourself? I mean, are you a daily internet user? I'll tell you my story after you tell me yours.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, I'll find myself, you know, sitting here at work all day on the computer, and then I'll go home and go and sit down at the computer there. I've gotten out of the habit. I've forced myself. It's like I've looked at the screen enough, so I've gotten better at not looking at my phone or not looking at a computer. But I'm definitely a heavy internet user.
How about the solitaire play? The hours of solitaire that you play during the show. Do you actually go home and play more solitaire?
Oh, you mean Candy Crush? No, I don't. I don't play. I have no games on my phone. I look at my phone enough without games, so I deleted everything.
Cyrus, no games, Simcoe.
Yep, I'm not playing.
That's a good moniker. I'm not playing around. That could be your motto.
That's right.
Well, I would. You know, I'll share my bit. I'm always online, and I don't mean like, you know. I mean, I don't lie in bed, you know, missing out on sleep or anything like that. But I use the internet constantly. I'm using it for interaction on email. I'm using it to do show prep. I'm show prepping all the time, as
but
you
that's,
know.
That's work. So that I wasn't that's counting true. That stuff. So what okay. about when it's not, it's pure, you're looking up something about the Beatles.
Like how, I do that too.
I know you do because you send me stuff all the time.
I do that. You know what I do? Here's just a little revelation. It's not, you know, not earth-shaking, but I love language. I love studying languages. I love learning languages. And so I have found this cool app. It's called Duolingo. Now, I have no connection with it. They don't know who I am. All they know is that they get my, you know, $9.99 a month or whatever I'm paying for it. And you can learn unbelievable amounts of languages if you want to. It's a structured language program. And so for me, it's very helpful because I can delve into, you know, refreshing, but also learning languages. So for me, I guess that's online, I guess, because it is an app. But that to me would be more of a hobby. And that's one of my big hobbies. What can I tell you? No heat, no judgment, Cyrus.
That's fun. My wife and kids use Duolingo, and they love
oh,
it.
Oh, do they?
Yeah.
So you know about it. What are they studying?
Spanish.
Okay. Yep. That's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. Si, senor. Well, yeah, I just thought people might be interested in that being online. Now, before we go to the phones, there's a related but unrelated story, and this has to do with, you know, the fact that your Facebook ID, your full name, your address, your birthday, and your email address have been hacked again from Facebook. Did you know about that, Cyrus?
I imagine that.
You're probably I don't know.
I'm not even surprised. I see these things. I only have it for the show. I had actually gotten rid of the Facebook, but when I took over working on the Patrick Madrid show on Facebook, they made me have a parent account. And so I just reactivated my old account, and I don't do anything on it. I don't look at it, but I do have it, and it's really annoying. I don't like Facebook.
I'll put in a good word for you at your trial.
Yeah, thanks. And just being honest.
Mark Zuckerberg demands every... Well, I know a lot of people who have jumped off of Facebook and closed it down. They say they're very happy. But here's the bad news. 500 million Facebook users have had their data hacked and available online actually for a while now. The availability of this data set was first reported by Business Insider. Business Insider says that information from 106 countries, including phone numbers, Facebook IDs, full names, locations, birth dates, and email addresses, among other things, are just sitting out there. And people are getting that stuff and, I guess, buying and selling it.
Do you think that has anything to do with the crazy number of calls I've gotten about my car insurance or my car warranty expiring?
Maybe.
Because it's
maybe
astronomical numbers.
It could. If you start getting Duolingo ads on your Facebook page, then you'll know that there's some connection. Maybe Facebook's listening. Facebook, as you know, has been grappling with data security issues for years. In 2018, this is when I guess this big breach took place, but nobody's really known about it or said much about it. Let's see. In December 2019, a Ukrainian security researcher reported finding a database with the names, phone numbers, and unique user IDs of more than 267 million Facebook users. That's, you know, not quite half, a little more than half, I guess, of the total of 500 million accounts that they're saying have been compromised. I'm sure mine is in there. I'm sure yours is in there. It said that this 267 million Facebook user hack included nearly all U.S.-based users of Facebook. He says this data is found out there and people are buying and selling it. Maybe a good idea to change your password, if you ask me. 888-914-9149 is the number. Well, we have people who are lined up now. We do have a couple of lines open. The number to dial again, 888-914-9149. Let's start off with Tom in Chicago. Hi, Tom. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well, thanks.
I just got a question for you. I'm dating, and it's horrible, but I've run into a lot of women. And I have a guy friend that, you know, convert to Christian, you know, they're not Catholic anymore. And they're like, which is fine. But I had a girl yesterday that questioned me. She's like, oh, man wrote the Bible. And I said, I think the 12 apostles wrote the Bible, you know. And I said, I'm not an expert at that. I refer them to Father Rocky. And I'm just getting frustrated with people. My question to you is, how do I respond to these people? I'd say, Catholic Church is, you know, this and that. It's not, you know, all the everything that's happened with the priests. I try to defend them. There's so much out there. There's so many people just bashing the Catholic Church. I'm just getting tired of it, you know, and wanted to get some insight on what you're thinking about.
Sure.
It.
I hear you. Well, you got a couple things there. So first of all, you got the scandals in the Catholic Church, and then you've got did men write the Bible? So let's take them in order. I would say to whoever is saying that to you, you know, well, men wrote the Bible. Yeah, so what? Men wrote the Constitution. Men wrote the big book of medicine that your physician follows. Men wrote traffic laws. Men wrote science textbooks that enable us to build bridges and understand the world around. So what? Who cares? Now, you can start by saying that to throw the person off balance. Because what they're really saying is the Bible is merely the product of human imagination. It's merely the thoughts of man. That's what they're really saying. But you need to flush that out a bit. So don't go on the defensive. That's my advice. Don't allow yourself to be put on the defensive. Just go toward it and just say, yeah, so what? And give, you know, umpteen examples of all the other important things that we all adhere to and recognize as authoritative, and just say, well, you know, men, and if you don't like the word men, you know, human beings, etc., wrote all those things too. So what? So what you're doing now is you're creating a juncture here where you can go in a couple of different directions, and you're not on the defensive. You've thrown it back in a nice way at the other person, and now what the other person has to do, without realizing what you've just done, is he now has to defend his position. Well, yeah, but what I mean is, you know, all that stuff about, you know, and then he might say heaven and hell or all that. That, you know, that's just something that was written down by men. Okay, so now you can defend that to the hilt. You can explain it and defend your position to the hilt, no question about it. But even before you get to that, what I would say to that guy is, oh, prove it. How do you know that it's merely the words of men? How did you come by that information? How did you arrive at that conclusion? And what you've done again now, Tom, is you've put the burden of proof firmly back where it belongs, and that is on his shoulders. So you don't need to go on the defensive, and then let him fight his way out of that paperback. So then he'll say, yeah, but these are thousands of years old, written by, you know, people who, you know, were wandering in the desert. And you can say, yeah, so, and so is a great deal of advanced astronomy that we derived from people thousands of years ago who lived in deserty places and rode camels, and they knew an awful lot about astronomy. Who cares how old it is? The question is it true? So this is my advice, Tom. This is more, this is in the area of technique, not so much in terms of what you would say, because there's so much that you can say. There's so much that you can say about, for example, well, I mean, have you ever really considered, have you ever confronted the evidence that Jesus Christ was more than merely a man? Well, what evidence? I read the Bible. I read the Bible 10 times. Yeah, I'm not talking about that. Have you ever confronted the evidence about who Jesus claimed to be? Much of which, of course, most of which is found in the Bible, but there are external sources, contemporary pagan authors in the first and into the second century who commented on this. They were hostile to Christianity, and they corroborate certain key details about the existence of Christ and his claims and his followers and even the claim of the resurrection. We see the same body of evidence in the pagan Roman writers of the day, those at least who commented on this, and there were few, but there were some. And a couple of them, like Pliny the Younger, were notable because he was dispatched by the emperor himself to go figure out what's going on with these Christians. So this is my point, Tom. You can handle it that way. That's how I would handle it. And then let the other guy squirm and twist and eventually back down, because it's just a claim. It's just a slogan. The Bible was written by men. So what? Who cares? A lot of other things were too that you hold dear. Okay, so that's the first topic. Second topic I think you asked me was, and now I forget what it was. Oh, the scandals. Okay, so here I would go in a different direction. I would say right up front, say, you know what, you're absolutely right. It is a terrible scandal, the things that have happened with cardinals and bishops and priests who have done terrible things, sexual crimes against minors and other people as well. And we don't explain it away. We don't try to minimize it. We certainly don't deny it. And we definitely don't defend it. It's a terrible thing. And yet the church for 2,000 years has been chugging along as Jesus said it would. For me personally, Tom, I think the scandals are in an odd sort of way kind of proof of the divine mission of the church. You may say, what? What I mean is that if you look back in time, you look back over the last, I don't know, 2,000 years of history, it goes back that far, you'll find scandals galore. You'll find scandals in the Catholic Church at every turn. It seems relatively infrequent in the history of the Catholic Church that there were brief epochs of calm when there wasn't some uproar going on. And of course, we didn't have social media back in those days, and there was no news cycle, and there was no way to instantly report the malfeasance and wrongdoings of people at a moment's notice the way we have it now. So some of it is sort of perception on our part. We perceive it as maybe, I don't want to say far bigger than it really is, because it's big, but maybe our perception of it is more exaggerated because we're bombarded with it constantly and instantaneously. Back in those days, whatever may have been going on wasn't communicated to the world at large. If there was a pre-sex scandal in Cairo, Egypt, 1,000 years ago, nobody outside of Cairo, Egypt knew about it. And most of the people in Cairo, Egypt didn't know about it. It would have been known locally. So keep that in mind. But I'll simply say this, that I see the scandals, as heinous as they are, as deplorable as they are, I don't know what all the right words are to use about this, but I would simply say, I think in a counterintuitive sort of way, this is further evidence of the divine mission of the Catholic Church, because we Catholics would easily have destroyed the church many times over had it not been for Christ guarding and guiding the church. Of that, I'm convinced. Maybe you can start with something like that, Tom. Thank you. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio, and when I come back, I want to share with you something about what's called the God hypothesis and how you can use that to talk to your atheist friends.
At the intersection of faith and culture, the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
All right, back to it. Or back on the chain gang, I think, as Chrissy Hynde would say. The number is 888-914-9149. When I get asked by people, what kind of show do you do? Sometimes it's easier to tell them what kind of show this isn't. So I say, for example, well, I don't have guests. I don't do interviews. I do take a lot of phone calls, your calls, and I do 3 hours of commentary And they, wow, what do you talk about? What do you talk about for 3 hours? And I say, well, you know, a lot of it is driven by what the callers are interested in talking about, what you are interested in talking about. But we get into current events and we talk about technology. And yeah, we talk about God topics as well. Cyrus says that I beat up on my producer. That's not true. That is not true. I involve you.
That's what you call it. Okay.
I call it involvement. Yeah.
All right. That's nicer.
I remember, Cyrus, as long as we're at it, the very first show that we did together when you first started working with me as a producer for the Patrick Madrid Show. And I remember vividly how maybe 15 minutes before we were going to go on the air, we're just sort of like talking about, you know, like the pre-flight check. You know, the pilots are going through the checklist and we're talking about all the things. And I remember you saying, and just, you know, FYI, don't ever ask me any questions. I never want to go on the air, not interested in talking on the microphone. And you made like a big thing about it. So as I recollect, within a minute or so of
maybe
the first
five
show,
minutes
in the, I had in the you fight. On the air kicking and screaming at first.
You dragged me. You dragged me onto this microphone.
It was great.
Uh-huh, I know.
And I've never let go.
You haven't. You won't let me. You won't
see,
let me.
See, you're a natural.
I want to go back into the shadows.
You're a natural. And by the way, there is actually a Team Cyrus on Twitter now. Did you know that?
Oh, no.
There is. Hashtag Team Cyrus. People dig it.
Don't do that.
It's already done.
Well, that's really nice.
What's done is done.
The thing is, the people that listen to the show are so kind. They're so nice. So.
Well, you know, I think they feel some empathy for you, or?
That's probably what it is. All right,
probably.
You know what, this is
attention, you are now listening to a filler portion of the Patrick Madrid Show.
All right,
for the next few minutes, Patrick and Cyrus will be talking about something of little to no importance. They're basically just flapping their gums for their own amusement, and you are well within your rights as a listener not to enjoy this portion of the program. That is all
right. Speaking of which, I posted a picture of Cyrus doing one of his hobbies at a park. It's on Twitter if you want to see it. I've never seen this kind of hobby before, but since I've gotten to know Cyrus, I mean, I see that he's got some interesting pastimes. So that's there. 888-914-9149. Cyrus has gone very quiet. So let's get back to the God hypothesis. I was talking about how I described the program, and one of the things I tell people is we get into God topics. And often that elicits, oh, really? Like what, for example? And that's my indication that the person I'm talking to, usually a total stranger, could be an Uber driver, for example, or, you know, somebody at a restaurant or something. But I find that at that point in the road, that kind of a fork in the road, if they're interested, once I mention God topics, if they're interested in knowing more, then they're quick to ask, well, for what, for example? But usually, I shouldn't say usually, sometimes, it becomes pretty clear that that phrase God topics and the word God might be the turnoff in the conversation because they don't follow up and say, oh, like what, for example? So when I meet people and they say, well, what do you do? I say, well, I do a radio show. Oh, tell me about that. So the reason this, I think, will be helpful to you, this is from Decision Magazine. It deals with the question of the God hypothesis involving scientific discoveries. And we talked about some of these scientific discoveries, three of them in particular, yesterday or the day before yesterday. So the same author, Stephen C. Meyer, he has his PhD in the philosophy of science. He's going to share with us here a series of points that we should have in mind in which scientific discoveries reveal that there's a mind behind the universe, that there is a mind behind the order and the laws and things that we see. So let's dive into this. This is something you can have at the ready the next time you're in a conversation with somebody who's interested in talking about God. He says, throughout history, many prominent scientists have believed in God. Far from seeing their faith in God as incompatible with scientific investigation, most have found the two things complementary. 17th century German astronomer Johannes Kepler, for example, he was born in 1571, he was a Protestant. He believed that science was only possible because God made the world to be intelligible to the human mind. In his view, the same God who designed the world in a rational and orderly way also gave human beings rationality so they could understand the world he made. Thus, Kepler described scientists as having the high calling of thinking God's thoughts after him. Many early scientists were not only inspired to do in science because they believed in God, but they also thought that the natural world revealed the attributes and reality of God. Now, this is not anything new, of course. St. Paul talks about this in his epistle to the Romans, where he talks about how, you know, nobody has an excuse to deny that God exists because you can see the evidence for the existence of God all around you. That was the thesis that St. Paul propounded, that nobody can really say deep down inside, I don't believe that there's a God, because how do you account for the cosmos? How do you account for all these things? Now, I recognize that St. Paul was not entering into a polemic with the, let's say, the, you know, the first rank of modern atheists who have all their rejoinders and all of their arguments and things at the ready. But his point is still true, that the cosmos is a natural revelation of the existence of God. The English naturalist John Ray, a founder of modern biology, this according to Stephen Meyer, wrote a book called The Wisdom of God Manifested in the Works of Creation, in which he affirmed that the power and wisdom of God could be understood from the things that are made. So how did we get from these great founders of modern science with their conviction that science reveals the handiwork of God to the modern new atheists like Richard Dawkins and others who think that science properly understood renders belief in God untenable? Answering this question requires understanding the critical issue of design. According to Dawkins and others, the argument for design in the universe long provided the strongest argument for the existence of God because it was based upon publicly accessible evidence. And yet, Dawkins insists that since Darwin, scientists have known that there is no evidence of actual design, only the illusion or the appearance of design in nature. But there really is no evidence of this sort of thing, is there? Or to put it a different way, is there really no evidence of actual intelligent design in the universe? Hardly, he points out. And we talked about James Watson and Francis Crick. These were the two English scientists who were trying to figure out DNA. And even as other people were making further advances in that field, by accident, they actually discovered the structure of DNA, that double helix. This was in 1953. The structure of DNA allows it to store information in the form of a 4-character digital code. Strings of precisely sequenced chemicals called nucleotide bases store and transmit the assembly instructions, the information for building the crucial protein molecules and the machines that cells need to survive. Let's stop and think about that for a second. Your body is comprised of cells. Your cells are organisms. They're alive. They're obviously not sentient, but they're organisms that include in themselves certain machines that are capable of doing things, building things, cleaning things up, etc. But these machines in your cells can only do what they do if they receive code. They have to receive instructions, like any computer. You fire up your computer or your phone or your tablet. The things that it can do, it's doing, as you know, but let's stop and think about this for a minute. It's only doing it because there's code there telling it what to do. If you fired up your phone and there was no code in the phone, there was no computer program, it couldn't do anything. It wouldn't do anything. So this is a very important thing to think about, that these nucleotides, these proteins and molecules, other molecules that are being built and made use of by the cells, in order for that to take place, you have to have this code that is precisely sequenced. If any part of the code is out of sequence, it just becomes gibberish. So he points out, Crick later developed this idea with his famous sequence hypothesis, according to which the chemical constituents in DNA function like letters in a written language, or digital symbols in a section of computer code. Just as English letters may convey a particular message depending on their arrangement, certain sequences of chemical bases along the spine of a DNA molecule convey precise instructions for building proteins. Thus, the DNA molecule has the same property of sequence specificity. Now, please don't let your eyes roll back in your sockets. Don't glaze over here. Sequence specificity that characterizes written text and computer code. Let's just talk about that for a minute. Sequence is, you know, what is the correct order of the information? And specificity is the information itself correct? So you could have a sequence of gibberish syllables. Blah, 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 blah. Those aren't even syllables. Let's just say gibberish sounds like I just made. That doesn't mean anything. So the sequence is there, I guess, like each of those different sounds following the other in a certain sequence. But that doesn't matter because those sounds don't mean anything. They don't convey any actual information. They're just sounds. So the idea of the sequence hypothesis or sequence specificity means both the sequence itself, but also the truth or the information that's contained. So he says, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist, himself has acknowledged the machine code of genes is uncannily computer-like. He's right about that. And he says that Bill Gates has noted that DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software we've ever created. Now, these were some tidbits that we found in a discussion that we had a couple of days ago about scientific discoveries that point to the existence of God, but we're going to go a little deeper into this particular one here. So he points out, since the 1960s, further discoveries made clear that the digital information in DNA and its cellular neighbor RNA is only part of a complex information processing system, an advanced form of nanotechnology that both mirrors and exceeds our own in its complexity. The design logic and the information storage density that's present in your body because of your DNA is superior. It exceeds what we can do on our own as human beings with silicon chips, etc.
Inconceivable!
Oh, just wait. And yet, he says, scientists arguing for intelligent design do not do so merely because materialistic evolutionary theories have failed to explain the origin of information necessary to build new forms of life. Instead, he says, we argue for design because living systems possess features that we know from our experience and variably arise only from intelligent causes. DNA contains information in a digital form and functions much like a software program. We know from experience that software comes from programmers. We know generally that information, whether stored in a computer program, inscribed in hieroglyphics, or written in a book, always arises from an intelligent source. So the discovery of information in the DNA molecule provides strong grounds for inferring that a designing intelligence played a role in the origin and history of life. Because let's pause here. What's the alternative? The alternative would be that if this precise and very specific sequence of information that is contained in your DNA that tells your cells what to do and enables them to do it, and to do it so precisely, you know, like, hey, grow a kidney, etc. If that didn't come from some sort of a mind who properly ordered then you'd have to say, well, then how did eons of time that went by with random blind forces working against each other, lightning strikes and a puddle of water and a dinosaur walks by it or walks over it and more lightning strikes and an earthquake and wind and more lightning strikes. I mean, we know intuitively that no matter how much time goes by, all of that stuff cannot result in war and peace, as I said the other day.
Well, that's debatable.
No, it's not. So, take your iPhone, for example. That's a very complex thing. It can do many different functions, but it's not as complex as your body is, and it doesn't contain anywhere near as much code as the DNA in your body does, and the DNA is very specific. This is why you don't have 10 arms or 15 eyes or no eyes, because the DNA in your body is very precise and orderly, and it tells the cells what to do. So the alternative to this theory is, if, you know, if the atheistic worldview is true and there really is no God and we didn't come from anywhere, we're not going anywhere, this is just a meaningless universe and it's merely what we think of as life anyway, just the results of these blind random forces working against each other over vast periods of time, that theory ultimately would have to say basically that it could produce an iPhone. Now, nobody actually says that because it's ridiculous. And yet they say the same thing about you. They wouldn't go so far as to say, well, you know, your iPhone, Your iPhone 12 with iOS 14.4 point whatever, that's just the evolutionary result of all these blind forces randomly working against each other over eons of time. Nobody would believe that because it's patently false. It's obviously false. And yet, the more we study the genome, the more we understand DNA, not just for humans, but just in general, living DNA, we recognize this is information. This is a code. So let's continue. But if life in the universe, he says, displays evidence of intelligent design, can science tell us anything about the identity of the designing intelligence responsible for life? So he refers to his book called Return of the God Hypothesis. He says, I address this question by showing that there are two basic options. The intelligence responsible for life is an intelligent being, either one, within the cosmos, or two, beyond it. In other words, the designer is either an immanent intelligence or a transcendent one, basically either an alien or God. Now, we as Christians, of course, we believe in a transcendent God. There are good reasons, he says, for thinking that the latter option provides a better explanation. First, an intelligence operating merely within the universe does not actually solve the problem of how biological information came to be. Purely undirected chemical processes have not been able to account for the origin of life because they have not been able to explain the functionality specified information in DNA has. In other words, the key signature of intelligence. Second, he says, and we're just about at the end here, so here's his conclusion. He says, second, physics has now revealed evidence of design in the very fabric of the universe. Since the 1960s, physicists have recognized that many physical parameters are finely tuned against all odds to make life possible. That's the Goldilocks scenario that we talked about a couple of days ago, where we live within this very narrow band outside of which life would be impossible. He says even very slight alterations in the values of many independent factors, such as the expansion rate of the universe, the speed of light, the strength of gravitational pull, or electromagnetic attraction, as well as the masses of elementary particles, would render life impossible. This fine-tuning, he says, moreover, has been present from the very beginning of the universe itself, and thus cannot be explained by any agent arising from within the cosmos. Instead, the fine-tuning of the universe is better explained by an intelligent agent that transcends the universe, one that has the attributes that we associate with God. Of course, many still dismiss evidence of design in life and the universe because it seems to support a belief in God. They attempt to stigmatize the design hypothesis as quote-unquote religion masquerading as science. Yet, the distasteful implications of evidence for intelligent design from an atheistic point of view are not grounds for dismissing it. Many scientists, he concludes, initially rejected the Big Bang because it challenged their idea of an eternally self-existent universe. We spoke about that too the other day. So he says, as Anthony Flew, the atheistic philosopher who later came to accept the scientific evidence both for intelligent design and God, he insisted we must follow the evidence wherever it leads. So that's his advice for lay people and scientists alike. Let's follow the evidence. Let's see where it leads us. And there's a tremendous amount of evidence in the area of design that points to the existence of God. I think it's time to take a break. So why don't we do that now, and we'll come back, including your phone calls. The number is 888-914-9149. We have some lines open right now, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Excellent!
The programming you hear throughout the day on the Relevant Radio Network is sponsored in part by Christendom College. More info at getprinciples.com. We thank them for supporting Relevant Radio.
At the intersection of faith and culture, The Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Welcome back. Hey, by the way, everything that we talk about, articles and such, everything is archived on the show Twitter feed, which is at P Madrid Show. And if you have the show page bookmarked, it's relevantradio.com/Patrick. The Twitter feed is embedded there, so you can find it at your one-stop shop. That's relevantradio.com/Patrick. Now, this being Holy Week, I'm sorry, this being the week after Holy Week, and Divine Mercy Sunday is coming up this Sunday, this is pretty much it for you to get your free copy of Drew Mariani's brand new book on Divine Mercy. It's called Divine Mercy. And it's filled with true stories of people whose lives have been dramatically changed for the better because of God's mercy. Some of these stories will just amaze you. And I want you to have this book. Drew wants you to have this book.
Yeah, these are
more than I do.
These are at the printing press now. So they're, yeah. We've gotten some calls like, hey, where's my book? It's come. Your book is coming, and Drew's seen them, and I talked to him yesterday. He's so excited to get these in your hands. So if you haven't signed up for this, there's no reason not to, unless you're one of those 7% that don't use a computer.
Well, that's true. So if you're in that 7% who doesn't go on the internet, I'm not sure what to tell you. But maybe tell one of your friends who is on the internet to go to relevantradio.com/mercy. And you can sign up. It's free, as we've been saying, absolutely free. You don't even pay shipping and handling. There's no penny out of your pocket for this book. It will arrive in your mailbox absolutely free. The only thing is you need to tell us where to send it. So go to relevantradio.com/mercy and sign up for your free book. And also, there's a share button there so you can sign up to give free copies. Again, absolutely free. There's no string attached at all for all of your friends and family. So maybe you have some wayward kids who could really use a big blast of truth, this would be the perfect time to do it, and it won't cost you a penny. So just go to relevantradio.com/mercy and sign up. This is going to be a huge print run, Cyrus. Massive. Beyond the typical book print run, because the demand for this book has been so high.
Yeah, it's really exceeded all expectations, and I've worked with Drew for 15 years, and I don't know if I've ever seen him this excited.
You know how some performers will have like permanent eyeliner tattooed around their eyes?
Okay, I don't know what that has to do with Drew.
Drew does not have that.
No, he does not.
But he seems to have like a permanent smile tattooed on his face.
Yeah.
And I think this book is just, because he knows the effect it's going to have on people.
Yeah, he knew how powerful. He came in, I still remember him coming in my office 4 or 5 months ago, and he was talking about this book and how powerful it is, and he was so excited about it. Way back then.
Yeah.
And so now it's just come to fruition. So good, you know, bravo to Drew. You did a nice job, Drew.
He did. When's your book coming out, Cyrus?
my pet,
what are you going to write about?
My expose on the Patrick Padrick show.
Yeah, what are you going to do? I mean, there's nothing to tell.
It's pretty boring.
Very boring.
Yeah, it's boring, yeah.
So that's not an answer. When's your book coming out?
Not for a while.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, you let me know when it's ready, and I'll promote it on the show.
I appreciate that. You have some books coming out. Your books are coming out in Spanish.
Well, yeah. As a matter of fact, one of them just came out in Spanish. That's a different one. ¿Dónde está eso en la Biblia? So, yeah, that's one of my new books in Spanish. I'm not here to give a commercial. So
no.
I'll just say, if you want to see that book, just go to relevantradio.com/Patrick, and under the link section, you'll find my books, and you can take a look at it. Anyway, let's get on with other things. Now, we have lines available for your calls. Why don't we start off with Tom in New Jersey? Hello, Tom. I understand you just called in. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much for taking my call. On the subject of the science, you know, proving how we determine the likelihood of, you know, random chance versus intelligent design, I was at a men's retreat a number of years ago, and they were talking about those strong forces and weak forces, as you laid out, you know, gravity and nuclear, you know, all these forces. And what he talked about was the odds of that happening randomly was 10 to the 10th to the 127th.
And
he said if you wrote that number out in long form, he said you couldn't fit it in the solar system if you wrote that number out long form.
Oh, my God.
So what he was saying is that if you're using science and mathematics to say, well, it's just happened by chance, mathematics tells us it's impossible that it happened by chance. Mm-hmm. So he gave it another analogy that they consider 10 to the 57th, if I'm remembering correctly, is considered impossible. That's like taking a million-piece puzzle, throwing it off the 10-story building, and it landing all in place.
Right.
That's 10 to the 57th. Exactly. So the probability of 10 to the 10th to the 127th is so far beyond mathematically just randomly happening, it is literally impossible through mathematics.
Mm-hmm. That's an excellent point. I didn't know that number. Tell me what it is again.
10 to the 10th to the 127th.
Oh, it's 10 to the 10th.
That is
And then that number is to the 127th on top of that, right?
Right. It's a double exponent, right?
Amazing.
So it's a tremendously large number. And there's a Father Robert Spitzer does a wonderful talk on this as well, reviewing the things that you just talked about the fine tuning, like gravity. If it was off by one, a 0 point, and then 49 zeros, and then a one, if it was off by that much, either the universe would have expanded way too fast or it crushed back in on itself. That's just one of those many numbers that has to be exactly right for everything to work. Mm-hmm. So what it all gets to, and not to be verbose about it, but all of these things accumulate to the point that it's not possible that it happened randomly. It can't have happened randomly. It had to be designed that way.
I agree. Did you ever see the movie Expelled with, who's the guy from Ferris Bueller again? Cyrus, you know his name. The guy who says
Matthew
Bueller.
McConaughey? Matthew Broderick.
No. The school teacher.
Oh, the school teacher.
I can see his face in my mind. It'll come to me. But the guy who's calling out the name Bueller, that guy. He's an economist. Anyway, I'm just blanking on his name, and everybody on Twitter is going to bombard me with his name right now. They're going to start telling me what it is. But in any case, he did a movie called Expelled, where he does interviews with various people, including Richard Dawkins. And to your point, Tom, in this interview with Richard Dawkins, he asks him, you know, I mean, you don't believe in Ben Stein. Thank you. You don't believe in God, but where do you think life came from? And it was fascinating because Richard Dawkins, rather than, you know, even slightly admit, well, maybe there might be a possibility, he just says, well, you know, it could have happened where aliens came in from a different place and they seeded the earth with life, and that's how it. So I find it, Tom, very straightforward, very compelling, impossible to argue against the point that you're making, which is, you know, kind of an echo of what we've been discussing on the program this morning. But it boggles my mind how some people who are so invested in the atheistic worldview, rather than consider the power of this particular point and the vast improbability to the point of being impossible that something that like this could happen just randomly, yet they're very willing to say, well, it could be aliens. You know, maybe guys with spaceships showed up and they put life on this earth. These fantastical notions are more readily believable to them than is something like what you and I are talking about. And I find that sad and amazing, quite frankly.
Yes, yeah. I think it's there is, if you go back to Aquinas's overall approach to basically this, if it's a very simplistic, I mean, to say it this way, but his tremendous absolute faith and confidence that if you pursue the truth, if you genuinely want to know the truth, he was not concerned about any methodology you want to use to pursue the truth, you will end up at God.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Fides querens intellectum, the Latin phrase, faith seeking in knowledge or intelligence. And that's very true, Tom. Thank you. I'm a big fan of St. Thomas, so I'm glad you brought him up. Thanks for the call. 888-914-9149. Maybe on the other side of this break, it might be worthwhile to just do a quick survey of five of the logical reasons why St. Thomas, building upon what Aristotle had said before, evidences for the existence of God. What are they, and how can you use those in a conversation? I'll share with you what they are. What you'll find interesting, too, is that they don't involve quoting the Bible. They don't involve invoking divine revelation or the church or councils or anything like that. It's just a matter of pure reason in considering what we see around us and what that must mean, and how can we account for things like that, including things like order. So we'll take that up as well. Cyrus, what's your call? Can we take another call or what?
Yeah, let's squeeze one.
I think we can. Okay, let's go to Joshua in Albuquerque. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, Patrick. I have a question on prayer and then one on Fulton J. Sheena, if I have time.
Yeah, you won't. Just give me your best question because we're short on time.
Okay. Since, you know, God knows everything from eternity and he knows what I'm going to do, instead of asking for things in the normal way, without going into divination, would it be okay just to ask him, what am I going to do today? and ask and wait for an answer?
I don't think so, because first of all, Jesus said, ask your Heavenly Father for those things that you want. Ask Him, because He delights in hearing it. Now, He already knows what you want, but He delights in you asking for them, and your prayer has an effect. So God's providence, which is His plan for your happiness and salvation, is constantly unfolding all around you, but you're still free to choose. So the reason I would steer away from that idea of, God, what am I going to do today, is because it has the connotation that you're somehow pre-programmed and you're only going to do what God is forcing you to do, what His computer program in you is making you do. And that's not really true. So rather, I would propose, Joshua, that instead of saying that you say, Lord, what is your will for me today? What would you want me to do today? And then give me the grace to freely do it. Because you can resist His will, you can say no to it and not do what He wants, but better that you say, Lord, you know, thy will be done. Show me your will and I'll do it. I would approach it that way. Does that make sense, Joshua?
Yes, it does.
Awesome. Well, save your second question for another time and call me back and we'll do that. In the meantime, we'll take a break and then we'll come back with more of your phone calls and your emails. And we'll talk a little bit about St. Thomas's proofs for the existence of God.